Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to this on-the-record press conference with NAMA negotiating chair Don Stevenson. Ambassador Stevenson will have a brief opening statement, then we'll take your questions. We have interpretation, so please use the microphones. In the back of the room, we have copies of both Don Stevenson's NAMA text and the agriculture text of Ambassador Crawford Faulkner. Ambassador Faulkner will brief after Ambassador Stevenson. There is also at the back of the room a press statement by Director General Lamy related to these texts. Ambassador Stevenson, please.
Thank you. Well, I guess we began with a lie because I'm not going to actually make much of a statement. My statement is my text. And in particular, the narrative piece that sits on top of the text is what I have to say about the issues. But I will make a couple of comments about where we are in the process. Let me just make a comment first about where we are in the process. The members of the NAMA negotiating group mandated me to propose a compromise negotiating text. When I say mandated me, I mean in an informal sense. That is to say that this text has no standing, it's agreed by no one, and it constrains no one in terms of defending their particular interests. The text is only intended to assist in the negotiating process by providing a point of reference for the next stage of the negotiations. Members will now be invited to negotiate from this starting point. On the basis of the members' reactions to the text and their negotiations with each other, not with the chairman, I intend to revise the text one or more times. The final agreement, therefore, may look like this text, or it may not. At the point of revising the text, and when members are ready, the negotiations will likely move to a more horizontal process under which all issues will be discussed together in the Trade Negotiations Committee and under the chairmanship of the Director General. It's impossible to be very precise about how long this will take. That is to say, how long it will take to arrive at a revised text. But I imagine it will take at least a few weeks after we resume in September. With regard to the substance of what you have before you, I know you've all committed both texts now to memory. But for those of you who just joined us, let me just say that in respect of my own text, I have proposed what we refer to as full modalities, or almost. That is to say, I have first a document that is my own comments, a narrative in which I try to situate or explain some of the judgments that I've made. I then provide the modalities themselves, the technical document that will provide the rules, ultimately, for the preparation of schedules. At this time, I was unable to conclude on three issues. The first was with respect to sectoral negotiations, negotiations on specific industrial sectors, which may go beyond the result in the formula. The second area was in respect of non-tariff barriers. And the third was with regard to environmental goods. If it's of interest, I can explain where we are in respect of each of those parts of the negotiations. I have proposed ranges in respect of the coefficients in the formula, and therefore ranges for the tariff reductions. For all other issues, I thought it was more useful to provide a specific outcome as the point of departure for the negotiations. The introductory remarks part of my document, the cover piece, will not survive into the next phase. They're only there to, as I say, explain the choices that I made. All that will remain at the end is the modalities, the rules for the preparation of schedules. With regard to comments on the substance of the text, as I say, it's a compromise text. It's no one's position, but rather my best guess at where members might find consensus on the issues based on what they've told me. The text challenges all members to compromise. And as I noted in the document, all members will have to compromise if they're going to find consensus. The math is pretty simple. There are considerable gaps between members on some of the issues, and those positions have to be bridged if there's going to be an agreement. So this text is a bridging exercise. Now, those of you who follow the history of the negotiations will know that on some issues there was agreement already. On some, there was pretty nearly agreement. And on some, the distance between members was still fairly considerable. And so there is a varying degree of bridging that is going on in this document. But the document challenges all members and proposes that all members contribute to the outcome. These are my best guesses, and they are based on what I roughly calculate as 1,000 hours of listening to the members on these issues. To the best of my ability to interpret what the members said to me, this is the members talking in this text. But it's not a pure science. I'm a chairman, not a calculator. Or a computer, so I've had to make some judgments. It's now up to the members to decide, and of course not just four members, but all members, and it's now up to all members to show leadership, and it's for every member to demonstrate political will to bring the negotiations to a conclusion. In the multilateral process, every member is equal, every member counts, and every member is responsible. I wanted to make only one other editorial remark with regard to the text before taking your questions, and that is with respect to the characterizations of the negotiations very often in the interventions that are made by delegates in the negotiations, and as a result, very often in news reporting about the negotiations. And that is that they are very frequently characterized as north-south, and the divides between the members are very often characterized in that way. And I just want to make the point, as I have in my text somewhere or other, in the covering note, that does not reflect the reality of the negotiations from my perspective. Again, a perspective that's only my view, but informed by about 1,000 hours of listening to the members. It is my experience that all of the issues in NEMA have developing countries on different sides of the issue. It's my experience in NEMA that as many developing countries are seeking access into other developing countries as there are developed countries seeking access to those same rapidly growing emerging markets. As I say, most of the issues in NEMA oppose developing countries. They have different perspectives. They all have different needs. They all have different exports. They all start from a different level of participation in the trading system and different levels of development. And it seems to me important to make this clarification because whether we succeed or fail, we should understand what divided us. And what divided us was not a simple north-south dynamic. It was the challenge of reconciling the disparate needs of 150, soon to be 151, members of the organization. And I make this point because sometimes in the characterizations we give to this issue, we are, first of all, incorrect factually. Second of all, we risk doing damage, I think, to the organization. So allow me that one point. Beyond that, I would only say that this deal is still doable. This deal is within the members' grasp if they want it. Let me ask for your questions.
Hede at first, and then Jamil, please.
Abdenabi, Kuwait News Agency. Would you please explain to me in layman's terms what is beneficial to the developing and least developed countries from this text, please?
I think it's a question that should be put to members rather than the chair, but to the extent that I wish to answer it, I did in paragraph 12. I don't think, to give some context to my answer, I don't think it is in the job description of the chairman to promote a particular outcome or defend it or to explain the benefits of the deal. My job is simply to try to find consensus among the members on the basis of what they have told me. Otherwise, I think questions about the benefits or lack of benefits from the deal are questions that should be put to members.
No, but this is a text presented by yourself, so you can just explain it in ordinary terms, not in World Trade Organization terms. How will the people benefit from it?
My answer is in paragraph 12.
Jamil, please.
Ambassador, two questions. First, in one of your hours of the 1,000 hours consultations, you met NAM 11, and they made it clear to you that they wanted the text, or they wished the text would have all positions so it could survive. The range that comes here is far below what NAM 11 thought. Do you think it can survive since it's far below? And secondly, by reading the paragraph 12, you made it clear that basically water is gone. If I can understand well, was that the intention? I mean, to have bound and applied completely equivalent. Thank you.
With respect to the text not representing all of the views of all members on all issues, it was my understanding of my mandate from the members that they did not wish to have a text that would simply rehearse everyone's position, that there would simply not be simply an inventory of everyone's position, which would move us forward not at all. I understood my mandate, and I think this was made fairly explicit, to move the negotiations forward by proposing positions that would bridge the differences between members. Whether or not this will survive is in the hands of the members and their reactions next week, their reactions before next week, and in particular their reactions at the negotiating table in September will be the key question. With respect to whether or not water was the objective in the negotiations, I think I make two or three paragraphs worth of comment in the early sections of the document about the different views on the value of water in respect of reducing bound rather than applied tariffs. I think I described them as both a contribution and a concession, and having value to the business community. That's my view on water. whether or not there was an intention in the mandate. There were no specific requirements in the mandate for the elimination of water. But as you will understand, in the negotiating positions of many members, they wished to increase certainty for exporters by reducing the difference between bound and applied, and indeed creating new commercial export opportunities by also affecting applied rates. That's not in the mandate, that's in the negotiating objectives of members.
Dan Prusin, please.
Ambassador, I was wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on why you didn't address sectoral negotiations in your paper, given the importance of this to a number of members who feel that whatever coefficient is agreed, it's not going to meet their ambition.
The sectoral negotiations are not far enough advanced for the chair to draw any conclusions with regard to their outcomes. This is likely because, in the view of many members, the sectoral negotiations, as I describe again somewhere in the text, are first of all voluntary, and second of all are to be decided after the results of the formula are known. In their view, this modality was intended to be complementary to the outcome of the formula. And so, in many members' views, this decision was to be made subsequent to the formula. Having said that, of course, all of these things come together at the end, and in final schedules, that is to say, the final deal, the results of sectorals would also have to be known. And so while some members have made the argument that the outcomes of sectorals should in no way be taken into consideration in the balance of the deal, that to me seems impossible. Again, as I describe in that part of the document, I believe it's in the narrative where I speak directly to sectorals.
Ravi, please, and then John.
Ambassador, it's odd to ask you questions on NAMA because the Doha mandate says agriculture is the engine of the Doha negotiations, and paragraph 24, which you know very well, talks of proportionality. But setting that aside, are you secure in your conscience that you stuck to the principle of less than full reciprocity? And also, are you secure in your conscience when you say middle ground? How do you define middle ground? For example, you say it's not taking an average of coefficients. What exactly does middle ground in terms of definition amount to percentages? And does it actually correspond with the LTFR as well as paragraph 24? I have more questions to ask later.
Well, the answer to the first question is yes, thank you. I think that with regard to the balance that's required in paragraph 24 or just the balance required in life, with regard to less than full reciprocity, I believe that this text satisfies those requirements, and I take this not from some particular calculation that I make or some particular definition that I give to the middle ground. I think my views in these matters aren't very important in the end. What's important is the views of the members, and I believe that I faithfully reflected the views of the members in respect of the outcomes that they are looking for in the NAMA negotiation. I assume from that that they find that these outcomes would satisfy them in respect of those balances. I would recall that on the several occasions that I did raise for discussion in the negotiating group the question of paragraph 24 and the issue of less than full reciprocity. The one thing that members could agree on was that they'll all decide for themselves. Thank you.
John, please.
Yes. Good afternoon. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the section on page 14 on the RAMS and your decision to give major economies like China and Taiwan a couple of years of grace period on top of the two-year implementation. And if you could elaborate in your discussions on the duty-free, quota-free, is there a possibility that it could go to 100% rather than 97% if, as some have pushed for? Thanks.
With regard to the grace periods, let me just make an important distinction in the text. Grace periods would apply on a line-by-line basis, so only on those tariff lines on which the obligation from accession had not been fully met, fully implemented, at least 2 years ago. So in that sense, every tariff line would have a two-year rest before further obligations needed to be implemented. The reason I made those proposals, that is to say 2 years of grace period and 2 years of additional implementation period, was because that was a bridge between the various positions of members. Some said longer, some said shorter, so I proposed something in the middle. With regard to the provision on duty-free, quota-free market access for least developed countries, I simply intended in the text to give effect to the agreement in Hong Kong. As it is, yes.
There were countries during your submissions, during the confessions from the industrialized world, who talked about a coefficient well below 8. I can cite the example of Norway, which had several times. And then when you take, for example, a middle ground in the industrialized, the coefficient for the industrialized world should be somewhere below 8. I mean, if it's not strictly a middle ground, some kind of an arithmetic equation, how did you arrive at this? I mean, it's still not clear.
You should become a member.
Isn't he?
The consultations that I undertook indicated to me that the majority of members sought something below a Swiss 10 with respect to developed countries, but something not very far below, something in the single digits. So that's how I chose my proposal, which was 8 or 9, which satisfies both of those requirements. It's below 10 and not far.
Dan?
Basso, I just want to go back to Jamil's comments about NAMA 11. I'm just wondering, how do you sell this text to the NAMA 11? Doesn't seem to be a whole lot there for them to make them happy. When you meet with them, as you inevitably will, what will you be telling them in terms of why they should sign on to this deal?
Well, I won't be selling this paper to anybody. This paper is my best guess at how to bridge all of their positions. And their positions, as you have noted in your question, can be quite disparate, quite far apart from each other. Ultimately, it's up to them to choose to come to agreement. And I won't be defending or selling this paper in any sense. But it is an informed guess of how to bridge their positions.
Brad, please, and then the last question in the middle.
Thank you, Ambassador. Can you define the treatment for the less than formula cuts in your flexibilities for developing countries? Because I see it shouldn't exceed 10% of the total value, but there's how do you define the less than formula cut? What's the limit for that?
Well, I think you're referring to what used to be called paragraph 8. In this text is paragraph 7, and it is the less than formula cut for developing countries that will apply the formula. And that provision has been more or less the same since the July 2004 framework was established, although the numbers at that point were in brackets, and I'm proposing to remove the brackets. It proposes simply that on 10% of tariff lines, those developing countries may take a 50% cut, I mean a 50% of the formula cut, or alternatively simply remove 5% of lines from the formula entirely to make no cut on them. But in both instances, there's a cap in terms of the trade value. In respect of Part A, it's 10% of lines, a 10% of total value of imports. And in the case of B, it's 5% of lines and a 5% cap total value of imports.
Sure.
Yeah.
On that B plus 3, the coefficient that they can add 3, was that something many members talked about? I know it's something Mexico and some others have, but was that, because that would seem to bring it close to, you know, 22 to 26 if they didn't use the, sorry, 23 to 26. Something 22 to 25. If they don't use that, the flexibilities, is that something a lot of countries talked about?
As you say, it was proposed by Mexico. It was supported by a number of countries, and it seemed acceptable to a number of others. With regard to some developing countries, this seemed attractive to them because they wouldn't have to decide which industrial sectors they would protect from the formula cut. And in the case of some of their trading partners, it was attractive, or it is attractive, because it would eliminate the uncertainty of knowing which sectors will be taken off the table, will be protected under paragraph then 8, now 7. So it seemed to me that there was wide enough support to leave the proposal whole and allow members to decide in the next phase whether it survives.
Last question.
Where will you have an open-ended meeting next week? When? The date?
I'm sorry, we haven't actually finalized the schedule, but my colleague, the ambassador from New Zealand and chairman of the agriculture negotiations, and I sort of intended to do half days starting Monday on both texts and go until members had exhausted themselves in terms of making preliminary statements on the text. So starting Monday and going until they're finished Tuesday or Wednesday.
Thank you all very much. Stay tuned now for Ambassador Faulkner, who will be with us in just a few minutes. Thank you.